Well, welcome everybody to another Nexus webinar. I'm your host, Andrew Estes. And today I'm excited to welcome our guest, Joseph King Bartley. Just a sweet name. Joseph is a versatile brother, to say the least. He's written songs for film and TV. He's toured as a musician, also planted a church in LA, and now dedicates a lot of his professional energy to helping accomplished individuals and teams who long for more, discover what they're capable of, generating the clarity and courage they need to experience it. He is a sought-after speaker and executive coach for like little companies like Netflix and Intel and several others. He's also the president of the Meta Performance Institute, and we'll unpack all of what that means. But Joseph is a remarkable leader, an entrepreneur, and I'm thrilled to dive into this conversation today. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Wow. Thank you, Andrew. I'm excited to be here.
I had the privilege of meeting and attending a couple of days of training with Joseph last year in LA, and I'm excited to introduce to our listeners just some of the concepts and ideas around the meta performance mindset and just all of that world and what that means. But first, I'd just love for some of our audience just to get to know a little bit more of your story, and having had a lot of the songwriting, the musicianship, like the church planting, just give us a high level of some of your story and just how God has just kind of led you from season to season.
I went to school and got a business degree, and then went right from that into professional music and right from that into planting churches. So, really typical path. But during that time, there's a memory that really catalyzed this latest chapter of my life, and it's waking up Father's Day years and years ago. And one of my favorite things to get as a gift is words of encouragement, words of affirmation. And so I love a card. And my family knows this, and every Father's Day, they have filled out cards for me. I wake up, I get to read these cards, and it doesn't matter what happens after that because I've gotten the encouragement from my family. But this particular Father's Day, I wake up and I open up the card for my wife, and it says, Joseph. And then she says some amazing things about what she saw in me as a dad. And then for my youngest daughter, dad, and then some encouraging things. And then next to that was just a post-it note for my oldest daughter. And the post-it note just said, "You've been a good dad so far." And
success.
That was funny, and she's got this wicked sense of humor, so maybe that's what she intended by leaving me just a post-it note. But I could not help, Andrew, but think about all of the relationships in my life up till then that, if asked what value our relationship or friendship was in their lives, I wonder if they would also have a hard time even filling up a post-it note. The people that I was wanting to impact were probably getting my best, and the people that I lived with were not. They were getting my leftovers. I was burning the candle at both ends. It ultimately led to a hospital visit where I had adrenal shutdown. I passed out on a date night with my wife. And so at that point, I hired a coach, among other things. It was a spiritual direction happened at that time. I also started in therapy, which I to this day still am in. I still have a coach to this day. And I still wanted to play a big game. I wanted to serve with everything that I had. I wanted to find out what I was capable of. And I also did not want to do that at the expense of those closest to me, of what I consider to be my primary ministry. And so I tried a lot of things over the years. But as I stuck with the principles that maybe we'll talk about a bit more today, I now can say that this last Father's Day, I got some pretty remarkable cards from every member of my family that I think the people that I live with would say that they get the best of me. And I have never been more excited about the work that I get to do now as an executive coach. So that may be a bit of a long way of saying this is how I've gotten to where I am so far in life, but I really care about this work for sure.
Yeah, that's super interesting, man. No, it's been a blessing, you know, just over the last year or so, just being connected to you and just kind of learning more about some of this world. And I was particularly drawn to just even some of your story, and would love to just kind of unpack, you know, just even some of your church planting journey, especially just for obviously our church planting network as we look into some of that stuff. So you were a professional musician. I mean, you're writing songs for like TV hits or different things, and a touring musician. What was your initial kind of call into ministry? Like, did you grow up in church? Like, was that always a part of your music, or was there kind of a pivotal moment that just kind of took you into what that world was?
I was raised in a church attending family, and that I consider that a gift. It was a rich experience. And so being involved in the local church and seeing God move through the local church and continue to nurture me in that context was like a non-negotiable. Being professionally attached to that was definitely not on the radar when I went to school. I spent my 20s in professional music, touring, and like you said, writing songs for TV. And I thought that was going to be the rest of my life. And during that time, my wife and I had been married a few years at this point, and we got very involved in a church in Hollywood. That's where a lot of my work was, a lot of my fellow musicians and colleagues. So it made sense for us to go to a church where we felt that we could invite the people in our lives who had never set foot in a church, probably would not have assumed they'd be welcomed in a church. We wanted to be a part of a place where we could invite them. And so we found an incredible ministry there that we plugged into. And then as so often happens, because humans are involved in the in what God's doing, there were some glitches and hiccups, and the leadership of this particular church decided to change up a lot of what they were doing. And the thing that we were inviting so many people to, and we'd seen impacting so many lives, was now not available anymore. So we decided to host, myself and several other families decided to host some environments where we could invite people and open up the scriptures. And we didn't think at the time it was going to be a church. We just wanted a place where we could invite people to have these big conversations. Well, very, very quickly that became a church. And that seems really passive and like, whoa, oh shucks, we became a church. But I think if you were to ask any of us at the time, that's kind of how it transpired. And we were leading from a place of passion for sure, but definitely not a place of strategy. And I love that. I love making sure that what we're doing is awakening, you know, the focus and the risk and the courage and living out our faith in really tangible ways, expecting God to do great things. I love that. But it also can be a recipe for, you know, your own like addiction to performance, if that's what's coming up for those, especially those that are listening to this. It could be if you have any sort of like overinflated martyr instincts, like I can't rest while there's still another life to be impacted, then that's going to, without a strategy, without clear boundaries, it's a recipe for burnout to lead with only passion, not strategy, not support. So the first couple of years were just a lot of time spent trying to do all kinds of things. Meanwhile, all of us had other jobs. I was still writing music, but we were essentially volunteering to start this church. Well, then a few years into that, the guy, friend of mine who was leading it, he was the lead pastor, was also a film director, and he at one point calls me into this little office we had we hosted the church in. And he said, "Hey man, I just really don't feel like I'm going to continue in this role. I don't have a vision. I think you should be the pastor." And I laughed at him. And I said, I'm flattered. I'd never preached a sermon in my life. I was helping out with music as I would, 'cause I'm a musician. So I was doing worship stuff there, but I said, "Please don't tell anybody. I appreciate this." I went home, I told my wife, and she laughed, and then we didn't talk about it again for months. But as God so often does, I just could not shake this idea that there was something to this invitation. And I can't even tell you, Andrew, that I prayed about it. I don't think I did. It nagged at me. And then there was months later, in the interim, that he the guy that was lead pastoring had told the board, hey, I'm going to step down. And they went on a pastor search process. So that had started. Well, several months later, this one evening, I said, you know what? I just can't shake this thought. I'm going to sit down with my wife at dinner and tell her I think maybe we should consider this. And so after months of not speaking about it, I sit down at dinner, and she's the first one to bring this up and said, you know what, that pastor thing from months ago, I think maybe you should consider this. And so we thought, well, maybe this is God going before us, uniting us in this next move. So that night I called the lead elder of the board and said, hey, I'd like to put my name in the hat for being the pastor of this church. And then he laughed. I'm like, I get it. That was me months ago. So he said, well, can you preach? I said, I have no idea if I can communicate. And the church was small enough. This will tell you everything you need to know about the stage of life we were at. But he's like, well, we need some help. So can you preach some messages over the next few months? I'm like, sure. And I found out, listen, I do have a knack for it. It seemed to connect. It created an impact. And longer story short, 5 months later, I think it was, I was then commissioned as the new lead pastor of this church. And in about a year or two, we went from a couple hundred people to over 1,000 in Hollywood. And for sure, that was God's miraculous movement. But there were some things that there were some strategies that we deployed that I have found were extremely effective in reaching new people. And of the 1,000, actually the statistic that I'm really most excited about from that season is that we had been doing a lot of surveys. I love data. So we would study like who's in the room. And on any average Sunday, between 35 and 42% of those in attendance would not have considered themselves Christians. And many of them had never cracked a Bible before. So that led to all kinds of new life and baptisms, and it was an example of us really taking our vision seriously to be a church for people who were convinced that church was irrelevant. And that seed had been planted years ago when we were in that one Bible study, or that one church, and then it became a Bible study, and then it became this call on my life. So, I'm happy to answer more questions about what was going on in that season, but that's kind of the whistle stop.
Yeah. Give me like high level, like when did you first start like kind of that church, and like when you became the pastor, and just like over the last 10 years or so, what did that look like?
Yeah. So high level, that would have been in 2009 is when the church was started in 2005. And then I think it was 2008 or 2009. Then I became the lead pastor. And then we decided to plant another church in 2014. It was either 2014 or 2015. We planted in North Hollywood, which is a different community neighboring Hollywood.
Okay.
And so we got to plant two churches during that time. So,
yeah. That's awesome, man. So, and then more recently, you kind of stepped out of that role to really go into coaching.
Yeah.
Tell me quickly about that transition.
Yeah, it was during COVID, during the lockdown, and in Los Angeles, they took it even more seriously than maybe other communities all over the world. And so we were functionally locked down for over 18 months.
Yeah.
And that became an intensely creative time for us, but it also, one of the benefits of that time, as hard as it was and debilitating and frustrating and sad, all of that for sure. But one of the gifts in the middle of that was that it created space for my wife and I to discern what was next. And I had already had the adrenal shutdown thing that I mentioned earlier in the conversation. And so I had a coach by my side. I had an incredible board who was supportive and gave me a lot of wise counsel. I was a part of a great network of other leaders and church planters from all over the nation. And so I was getting a lot of really, really great support and wisdom through that season. And the question on my mind at that time, so this would have been 2021, was, God, I want to be obedient. And if you're calling me to essentially revitalize this church post lockdown and COVID, I will be obedient. And if you're not calling me to do that, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want to be obedient. And it became clear that we were not through lots of different circumstances, I'm not going to revitalize this church. So I met with the board. We decided to dissolve the church because we hadn't really functionally met back together again. And in dissolving the church, we didn't have any debt. We didn't have a building we had to liquidate because we were meeting in a high school. So we were able to cash out and then invest in 17 church plants as a result of that. One of which came right from our church. So there was a church plant that still is serving in the valley of Los Angeles to this day, and it sprung out of the church that we dissolved. And so it's amazing what God did through that. And then I went on a pretty quick search for what would be next, and executive coaching was on a short list for me because I'd been so impacted by it. So I had firsthand experience of the role this could play in somebody's life. And so then at the beginning of 2022, I began my certification journey to become a meta performance coach and then ultimately join Novus Global, which is a boutique executive coaching firm.
So, yeah, that's fantastic. So I got introduced to, from just a mutual friend, guy had recommended like the Beyond High Performance book by Jason Jaggard, and really read through that and was really just kind of impressed by all the material. It was really funny though, because I ended up just checking Jason Jaggard out like on Facebook or something like that. And it turned out that I had a mutual friend with him. And that mutual friend happened to be one of our Nexus church planters, a guy named Jeremiah Holcomb, because Jason actually went to, and his sister Amanda, who's a part of Novus Global, they both went to Manhattan Christian College, which is actually like a part of our like faith tribe, just restoration movement stuff. So I went to Ozark Christian College. And so it was just this weird little connection. And
like
so,
it was meant to be.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Yeah. So we ended up diving into the book and just love the material, and just some friends that were just really kind of going into that with, another team that I'm a part of. And so being able to just kind of approach that topic, would just love for you to just introduce to people who are just unfamiliar with what is meta performance, mm-hmm. and just this idea of beyond high performance, to be able to go into that. So just for somebody that's unfamiliar with that, what is meta performance?
Well, let me say first, it has nothing to do with Facebook and Meta and Mark Zuckerberg. There is no copyright infringement either way, but it is based on a root word that we've used many, many times before in language. Meta as in change or new, like metamorphosis, transformation. And meta performance is a particular way of showing up and behaving in life where it creates transformation for you and for others. And this is, even though we've sort of slapped our label on this, it is a timeless idea that I think describes what it really means to thrive as a human. It's what we're created to do and how we're created to live. And meta performance, in short, is someone who's showing up with a meta performance mentality is thinking of a couple of things. One is we are radically underestimating what we're capable of. And that's a framework, a question that we answer to constantly. We can always be asking that question, whether circumstances seem really dire or whether we feel like we're at the top of our game. We can still be asking the question, huh, what are we capable of? That's a meta performance question to be asking. Meta performers also are people who care about not so much only the results that we've marked out for ourselves, the KPIs or the numbers that we're going after, or the goals that we've set for ourselves. Those matter, but really we see those goals, Andrew, as a Trojan horse in which we deliver life transformation. Who do we get to become as we go after this thing that used to feel impossible to us? How do we show up in the world? What kinds of communities would we create around us? What bold risks would we take if what we're really up to is something that different, outside of what we're used to? So we might get to our goal, we might exceed our goal, but by chasing after it, we become different people, and that really becomes the most exciting widget that we create as meta performers. The last thing I'll say about it is that meta performers realize that there is more to life than performance. And we are A lot of times in the life coaching space or the executive coaching space, there's this very helpful framework of moral neutrality where we're kind of hands off and we won't tell you what we think you should do because we want to create a space where Andrew shows up and he is self-generating an idea of what he feels called to do or what he thinks is the next best move. That's wonderful. And as meta performance coaches, we do have a slight moral leaning as we partner with individuals, leaders, and teams and cultures. So even when I'm doing work with the companies that you mentioned before, as we work with professional athletes, we really, really are excited about increasing what we would call nobility. Some of your listeners and some of your planters would understand this as kingdom principles. Whether or not someone is a follower of Jesus or thinks that there is a God who handcrafted them for this life, we do believe that every person longs to live out generosity and community and creativity. We think you're built for it. And as we're going after your big numbers and your big results and your big trophies, how will the world be shaped and changed because there is more nobility available as we go after this thing? There's more generosity springing from your life. There's people are prospering because Andrew is showing up in a different way. We really, really care about the impact you're making, not just the performance that that you're creating. So those are a few kind of high-level concepts of meta performance and how we know that we're really cooking with gas
is one of our answers to those ideas. A couple of the things that have really kind of stood out to me is initially was kind of the 10,000 hour versus, you know, some of the other pieces that you talk about, but then also just the contrast, and I let you just kind of introduce that, let you talk about that, but then also just the pyramid of what is just the strain or maybe the tension of what it is to me to be straining to be a high performer.
Yeah.
From like questions that low performers ask or like high performers ask, and then what goes beyond some of those type of things as you're kind of introducing this mindset or this framework.
Yeah. Andrew, that's great. Thanks for teeing that up. We know that in life there are different kinds of questions. There's questions that we answer and there's questions we answer to. Questions we answer might be 2 + 2 = what? That's a question that has an answer. And then there's questions that we answer too. A question such as, what would love demand of me in this circumstance? That's a question we can always be answering too. It calls us into any number of creative behaviors. When we think about performance, we notice that whether you know it or not, the way that you're showing up in the world and the way you're performing, the way our teams are performing, is usually answering to a certain question, and that question is creating a certain outcome. So when we notice low performance in our teams or in our lives, we're probably answering to the question, what is the least I can do and get away with it? What's the least I can do and not get fired? What's the least I can do? Now there's another level of performance which might create different results, and we would just call that generic performance. Just nice boilerplate standard performance. And when we're showing up with performance, we're probably answering to a question like, how do I do a good job? How do I get a passing grade? How can I be faithful in this? Really good questions to ask, but it creates sort of a standard level of performance. Now, in many areas of our lives and many people that we're surrounded with, we're probably showing up with a high performance mindset. And we're creating high performance results. And a high performer is probably answering to a question like, how could I be the best at this? Or how could we win at this? And we would think that, man, our lives would be better if more people were asking that question, if they were answering to that question. But we have found that if the best performance that is available to us is high performance, we're going to get some pretty cool results. We're going to rack up some trophies. There's a lot that we can be proud of. We're going to get a lot of A's in the class. We might raise a lot of money for our next campus or for our church plant. Like, there's a lot of good results that can happen as high performers, but it also comes with some limitations. If that's the best kind of performance we can bring, oftentimes a high performer or high performing cultures will create this really odd cul-de-sac of feeling overwhelmed and bored at the same time. High level of activity and yet kind of a detachment from thrill and enthusiasm. High performing cultures generally create competition in a way that's not healthy, because only one person can fit on that pedestal or on that platform. High performers a lot of times start to be resistant to feedback because their identity can be attached to how successful they appear. So any feedback towards their on their performance actually feels like it's downgrading them from this who they see themselves to be. And I could go on and on. So if high performance is the best that is available to us, then we might run ourselves into some dead ends that could be disappointing. And some of your listeners are might even be recognizing some of that in their own lives. Now, before I tell you the meta performance thing, which we've already alluded to before, I do really quickly want to say that the different levels of performance are not bad. They're not like high performance is not better than low performance. There are areas in our lives where it might be perfectly appropriate to show up with a low performing mindset. When I think about what's the least I can do and not get fired, I think about doing the dishes. And I would love actually to be fired from doing the dishes, but I'm not trying to high perform doing the dishes. When I think about performance, I think about my taxes. I want to do the very least I can do. I want to do a good job at my taxes, not the least I can do, but I want to do a good job. I want to be legal, but I won't do any more than that. And then, of course, high performance is great. Sometimes it's really great to show up with that kind of stop at nothing. I will create this win. I want to be the best dad I can possibly be. And it's created some really great results. The meta performance question of what are we capable of becomes a resource for us that I talked about earlier, where we can always be exploring what we're capable of. We can be asking questions that explore things that are outside of what anybody has experienced before. And it's the people who live in a meta performance mindset that really do shape history. Whether they would have called it that or not, but people who really are trying to figure out, wow, we serve, for this context, we serve a God who's capable of doing imaginably more than we could ask or even imagine, immeasurably more than we could ask or even imagine. So if that is the God that we serve, then we can always be asking the question like, wow, I know things seem tough. I know that we feel like the story has already been written, but man, what are we capable of in this moment? I know that we're in a tough context where churches go to die. But wow, if God is with us, then who could stand against us? What are we capable of in this circumstance? Man, I know that we are crushing it. Holy cow, there's so much to be excited about. And let's celebrate that for sure. But man, what else? If we're capable of this, what else are we capable of together? And so we can continue to live with passion and excitement for the future. So that's a few.
Yeah. Within a pastoral context, when you think of just like what is just basic performance or like low performance, or even, you know, just having that the total lid off and just going straight meta performance in pastoral leadership, what are some of the nuances or some of the things that how you might adapt or how you might contextualize that type of a tool for ministry leaders?
Oh, that's great. Well, first and foremost, I think it's helpful for any leader, particularly church planters and pastors, to check in on what question they might be answering to in this particular category of their performance. So when they think about preaching or when they think about creating their teams, if their mindset is what's the least I can do and not get caught, that might create results that are disappointing. Before we talk about all the behavior change that may need to happen as a result of that, maybe start with the mindset of, okay, that there's a different question that might be more helpful for me in this context. So that's the first thing, is just a self-check. What question am I answering to right now? And what are the results that that's creating? Is there a more helpful question to be answering to? But then when I look out at, the activities of church planting, I would say more often than not, what I've noticed is that the high performance traps are are everywhere. I don't think many people plant a church because they're trying to be low performers for the kingdom. I think maybe next to being a single mom, I can't think of a harder job on the planet than being a church planter. And so many men and women get into get on teams and they want to be a part of planting a church because they want to change the world. And even though they may not use the language of how could we be the best at it, they are thinking like, how could we, it's even in the language of how could we win people for Christ? How could people see our good works and glorify our Father who's in heaven? Like, how could we really show up in an exceptional way? How could we be excellent at serving people? And again, not bad. What a great place to start. But it also can start to breed, especially early on, it starts to breed certain things that might be, they create dead ends. For instance, I've noticed that when you first get a church started, the mindset is, listen, we're not really going to call people into, I used to say that when you're first starting planting a church, we want people who are willing or able, but we'll settle for willing. And there's a whole lot of people who are wearing all kinds of hats because you just need somebody who can fog a mirror, who might be able to move the chairs for you. And, you know, it's okay if, you know, members of the band are awful as long as we have a band. I get it when you're getting started early. But then sometimes there is this really insidious thing that sneaks in early on and then kind of sticks around, which is then we still have to provide absolutely everything. Even if God hasn't provided the people, we still need to make sure that we've provided all of the things. And usually the responsibility to deliver all the different small groups and all the different ministries and all the different bells and whistles of maybe a more mature, more resourced ministry, usually the responsibility of that is going to follow to the highest performers in a culture. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's going to be the lead pastor, maybe the lead pastor's family. It might be a few really gung-ho people early on in the planting team. And they are going to be less attentive to their own rest and their own boundaries because there's still a mouth to feed for the ministry. And even as God provides more and more people and more resource, that mentality still sticks around. And you'll notice that there's still burnout at year 4 and year 5 because we haven't trusted that God will provide the people and the resource on time. That Jesus already died for us. I don't have to kill myself for this ministry. I know I'm speaking a bit abstractly in this because it can show up in a lot of different ways for our listeners, but the mindset that creates that kind of stop at nothing to serve people that might get you started well is definitely not the kind of mindset that is going to sustain you in a healthy way. So
yeah, one of the things that just kind of as it occurs to me on you mentioned in one of the trainings that you talk about like the two greatest leadership challenges, and it's just really just going towards asking that question of what really are we capable of, and the first challenge you mentioned is like every leader vastly underestimates what they're capable of. But the second one, specifically in relation to like church planting, like every leader vastly underestimates what their team is capable of. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost even thinking, and just kind of kick this to you and just see your thoughts on it, is just this, the tension and the struggle of control early on from pastors, and maybe not even early on, just even in established churches, that we have this tension of not being able to release authority. And not being able to like raise others up around us for maybe how it might feel for us personally. Maybe it's threatening to our leadership, and that could be like a high performance kind of a trap. But when you start asking that question of what is our team capable of, or what is our church capable of, do you think that that just moves beyond in a different way? Or how might you kind of consider some of that?
Yeah, that's good. I think there's, in my experience, there are a couple of different habits around finding out what we're capable of and finding out what the body is capable of, or the church is capable of, the team is capable of. There's two sort of odd mindsets that conspire together to create disappointment. One mindset is, I cannot release authority until somebody is perfectly suited for this role. So it's a high level of control. We can call it high standards. And I'm not talking about moral authority. Like, obviously, we, you know, we want to pay close attention to use the word, to doctrine and to character, for sure. That aside, let's say those things are aligned. Now we're talking about competence, maybe even cultural fit to some extent. And we will say that our standards are really high, that we're slow to hire and quick to fire, a lot of different, again, not bad, but just a lot of different mindsets that might keep the control very, very high. At the same time, in a lot of church cultures, because we are communities of grace, we also are very, very slow to give people direct feedback, to give them responsibility, because that might expose that they've got some immaturity in their lives, or there's some development there that still needs to happen. And so it's almost like you need to either perfectly fit the role, or you are, you get to sort of coast, like, because you were willing to do it early on. We're not going to invest in your development. And so you have this really weird imbalance, in my experience, of a really strict gatekeeping in certain roles, and then also a lot of tolerance of mediocrity and underdevelopment in a lot of other roles. So those can happen in the same culture, which is really interesting. The space that I would invite us into as meta performers is the space in between that, where you talked about the 10,000 hour rule before. Like, as long as we're doing this work together, what if the work itself becomes the perfect laboratory in which our characters are matured? What if it becomes the perfect laboratory in which God is going to shape us? The perfect laboratory in which we can find out what we're capable of? We might find that the high control mentality, we might relax that a little bit to allow people to take on responsibility, not because they're perfect for the role, but because, wow, what would it look like for us to develop them into the kind of leader who really can succeed in that spot? At the same time, we might allow not only people to participate on a lower level, but we are going to put in structures where we use that as a way of developing them and finding out that, wow, there's capacity in this church that I would not have identified if I was waiting for somebody to be more perfectly suited for our plan early on. So you might find there's creativity in the room that you never knew you had. You might find that there's people who are gifted in finance and administration operations that you never knew you had. But by giving them some lower points of entry and then being dedicated to their development, we get to find out more of what we're capable of. So those are a few things that come to mind as we're speaking sort of in generic things, but I hope your listeners can kind of apply it to their context.
Yeah. No, there's a couple other tools like that just really stood out to me, really resonated with me in some of the meta performance training toolbox. And would love to unpack just a little bit, just a high level introduction of a couple of them, but the vision and reality gap. Yeah. Vision reality gap, or however the order that you say that in, but talk to us a little bit, maybe just about the role of vision for a team and an organization, or even in a church. What is that? And then just the reality and the gap that teams often find themselves in. How do you specifically kind of, like, what are some principles that you kind of coach through in that regard? Yeah.
That's great. Your listeners are going to have their own working definition of what a vision is. Like, what do you mean when you say vision? And it's probably some version of, it's a clear picture of the future. A vision is, you know, it is a goal. That might be a way that they define it. But for the purpose of this conversation, let's say that a vision is something like a clear picture of the future that incites passion in us and in others. Or it's a clear picture of the future that justifies the pain of transformation. That's another way we've defined vision. But it's some clear picture of the future. We're not there yet, but it's a clear picture of the future. Then we also have this pesky thing called current reality. And that's where you and I are at today. And current reality is however our finances occur to us, our abilities occur to us, the resources that we have available to us, as far as we can tell, you know. So that's our current reality. And when we think about the distance between our current reality and this big, exciting, thrilling, passion-inducing vision, we have something that many people call a gap. It's just the distance between where we are and where we say we want to be. And when we think about that distance, all kinds of emotions come up. So don't be surprised if when you think about that gap, you are feeling overwhelmed. When you think about that gap, you're feeling stressed. Your teams feel stressed. When you think about the gap, you feel shame because other people's gap is not that big. Other churches' gaps are not that big. You feel embarrassed. You feel afraid. What if it doesn't work out? Now, those are natural responses to the gap. That is the brain that God gave you working the way it's supposed to work because your brain is trying to protect you. And it's telling you stories to keep you safe. And there are times when being afraid is really, really resourceful. When my kids were much younger, I wanted them to be afraid of a hot oven. When they were younger, I wanted them to be afraid of running out in the middle of the street. I wanted them to be afraid, and I wanted that to drive their behavior. So your brain's doing its job if you feel afraid about the gap and overwhelmed. And sometimes your brain overplays its hand. And if that's the only thing you have to work with is fear, then I don't blame you for doing one or both of two things. One is, let's reduce that vision. Let's make that gap a little bit smaller so that the overwhelm feels a little bit more digestible. No problem. Another thing that I notice I do and others do is let's inflate our current reality. I loved my Sunday afternoon estimations of how many people were in the room and how many lives were changed. Like, there was probably a million people there. That was me inflating my current reality. And it's probably because I didn't like the uncomfortable feeling of like, wow, there's still some distance between where I'm at and where I think God's called us to go. So I would invite, and we do this with our clients all the time, I invite our church planters and pastors and leaders to be thinking about this. Also, what if there's a different way of relating to that gap? What if we could learn or choose to love it? To love it so much that we would create one in an area where we don't know we have a gap? What if we inject a new vision into our marriage, inject a new vision into our parenting, inject a new vision into our church leadership and our culture, a new vision that is so audacious and yet so clear that the gaps become obvious? Wow, we are not there yet. Wow, we've got some growing to do. Wow, we probably need a lot of help. And then learn to love that, because that gap that is being created is your life. Right now, Andrew, you and I are living in that space between where we were 5 minutes ago and where we would love to be 5 years from now. We're living in that gap, whether we've identified it or not. So when I say let's love that gap, what I'm really inviting you to do is let's love the journey. Let's love life, because you will die with gaps. So if we can learn to love the gap, then that means we keep that vision firmly in place. This is that clear picture of the future that's worth going after. And it also helps us be very, very sober about our current reality. Let's not lie to ourselves about where we are. So that, great, now we found a gap. And when we do that, when we learn to love the gap, then the third way we close it is not going to be by reducing the gap, but instead it's by growing into the gap and growing closer to that vision. Yeah. So
yeah,
that's the concept that
that's fantastic, man. And I feel like there's a couple of tools that I'd love for you to talk about. One of them feels like it was directly related to the vision. One of them directly related to our reality. And with the vision tool is just the idea of the intuitive fence and what really feels possible and what just feels completely intangible. And it's interesting and I'd love to have you just like explain that tool, but then specifically like in a faith stretching type of an environment and a ministry type of environment that you already quoted the verse, like, you know, that God can do immeasurably more than we can ask or imagine. And that by nature just stretches us to go a little bit longer, but I'd love to have you just kind of introduce that tool or just like how you use that to help people set a really stretching and compelling vision.
Yeah, the intuitive fence is something we all have, and it's an imaginary electric fence. And inside that electric fence is what you and I think is reasonable, possible. Right now, your brain is estimating what is reasonable in the next 12 months. And if we sat here and slowed it down and said, Andrew, what do you think is possible in your ministry in the next 12 months? You would have some details that feel reasonable to you. Oh, we'd probably grow 10%. Oh, we might hire two more people on the staff. I'll still be married in 12 months. That all seems reasonable and good. That's great. And your brain is sending you messages that like, yep, let's estimate things that won't disappoint us, that we have, there's a high, it might require some activity, but there's a high likelihood that we'll get to celebrate some of it when we get there. That's inside your intuition or your gut. We'd say your intuitive fence. And then there's a whole host of things that right now your brain is telling you are outside of that electric fence. They're outside of what feels reasonable and possible. You might even call it fantasy. But man, it would be so great if somehow, by some miraculous move of God, we get to experience that. And as we start to increase what we want in the future, or what we feel called to in the future, we'll notice in our bodies and in our brains and in our emotions, as the vision gets closer and closer to that electric fence, we'll start to feel these signals of, oh, that's starting to feel impossible. And maybe you feel like a pit in your stomach. You start to feel nervous. You might even giggle at it. You might start feeling some of that gap, like the overwhelm and the stress and the shame and the self-doubt and the imposter syndrome. And like, I'm not the kind of person who's going to get us there. So that's, rather than that being a reflection of reality, that's just a reflection of your brain telling you what it thinks is inside the fence and outside the fence. So we have a tool that's, you know, better experienced than explained, but a tool where we say, okay, let's come up with one version of the future. Let's pick a date on the calendar. It's the end of the year. It's New Year's Eve, and we're celebrating a year wrapped up well. What's a vision of what's happening in our ministry and what's happening in our personal lives that feels well inside the fence, but really exciting? My marriage is still intact. We've reached 5% more people. We've raised this much money, and we've launched this ministry. Man, it's going to be a lot of work, but it's going to be a lot to celebrate at the end of the year. And it feels reasonable. Like I kind of know how we're going to get there. I can already see the resources and the team around me. Other churches have done it. So probably I'm not crazy for thinking it. Okay, that's all inside your fence. Now come up with a version of that same vision that feels like it's just outside your fence. And the way you would know that it's helpful and productive is it would be clear and measurable. It's very specific. It feels impossible. And the way we test for that is that you're not totally sure how you would get there as we sit here today. Like there's going to be some transformative ideas and way of being that'll have to happen. And then number three, it's got to feel exciting, thrilling, passion inducing. That's how we know we have an outside the fence meta performance vision. And the last thing I'll say about that, because I'll often get this, the question here when I lead clients through it, and I've gotten a chance to coach some local church pastors as well in the last couple of years, and they'll say like, well, how do we know the difference between a helpful vision and a fantasy? And that's a great question. Because I had a client say this quite some time ago. He's like, well, what if I told you that my outside the fence vision is to play in the NBA? And here he's a 5'2 man in his 50s that weighs 270 pounds. Like, what if that was my vision? I would then say, okay, well, let's just imagine there's a world in which it's somehow you were committed to that. There's surgeries, there's training, you'd probably have to quit your job, the amount of time you'd be spending, the coaches you would hire to give it, to even increase the likelihood that you would be playing in the NBA. Would you be willing to do that? And that particular gentleman said, well, no, I'm not going to do all that. I'm not going to quit my job and tell my family I'm going to go live for this NBA dream that I have now. And okay, great. Then that's a fantasy. Now let's talk about a real vision. Well, okay, I want to 2x the amount of people that we're impacting next year. I want to only be focusing on my three areas of genius and calling, because there has been remarkable people deployed to handle everything else in ministry. I want my wife to say this is the best year of our marriage ever. And I want to take my kids on a one-month trip overseas where we're spending time 2 weeks on the mission field and 2 weeks just having a blast. I want to do that next year. And then I might say, and I'm making that up, but I might say, oh, does that feel, that feels specific to me. Does it feel, do you know how you're going to get there? I don't totally know how we're going to get there. Great. Would it be exciting if somehow we could? Yeah, that would mean the world. Great. Now we have a vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's great, man. Yeah. So it's your, yeah, just being able to stretch people's thinking, being able to really push people beyond what they really think is reasonable or attainable.
Can I say one more thing about that, Andrew?
Oh, please.
I think this might be helpful because your leaders might want to do exercises like this with themselves or with their teams. Right now, your brain is estimating what is possible in the future. And your brain loves nothing more than being right. And so it is going to look for evidence all around you to reinforce its conclusion about your future. So what if you can redirect that energy, that wanting to be right energy, towards a future that you would love to live in? And let your brain prove itself right about that. Because both versions of your future are make-believe. We're sitting here today. We're not sitting in your future. We're not sitting in next July, next August. So you have two visions of the future. You get to choose which one you give yourself, give your brain something worth being right about, as long as it's addicted to being right. And what if we proved ourselves right about what God is capable of with this big, audacious vision outside the fence? So,
yeah, that's fantastic, man. No, for dude, I could sit here and talk to you for hours about some of this stuff. And just with the few minutes that we have remaining, I would love to just quickly talk about just the idea of the reality, and specifically about the concept of ownership and the little fortune cookie phrase that you guys often help people recognize. I'd love to tee that up and just to quickly talk about just the ownership of what is, like, just recognizing, like facing facts, not trying to inflate whether it's numbers or our reality in any given way, but just coming to grips with this is truly what is. So I'd love to start there and just kind of quickly get your talk on that, and then we can wrap.
Yeah, I'll be concise with this. Exploring how much agency and ownership you have in any given situation is like finding $20 in your pocket that you didn't know you had. So if you right now are feeling stuck, if you're feeling like it's too late, exploring how much more agency you have, even if it's 1% more agency, is like finding freedom that you did not know was available to you. It's like finding a little crack in the brick wall that you thought was a stop. What if it's merely just an obstacle? What if it's a speed bump towards your future? And exploring your ownership and agency is a way of unsticking yourself from that. A couple things to say about it really quickly is we will often intuitively add a phrase to the end of our current complaints that keeps those complaints in their place. And that phrase is, it is what it is. They will never, it will never, I will never, it is what it is. And that is a way of again, your brain proving itself right about a conclusion you've drawn of your current circumstance. It frankly, if we're honest with ourselves, it is also a way of us not taking a risk because risk scares us. So I'd rather just say it is what it is and put up with it. So what we will do is there's multiple tools for this, but we will then invite people to try on a lens of ownership. And that lens might look like, ministry has not grown in the last year because it's exactly the way that I want it. Just try on the lens. I'm not saying it's objectively true, but if you see your circumstances through that lens for a moment, how might that be true? How might it be true that your ministry has not grown in the last 12 months because it's exactly the way that you want it? What are you choosing? What are you avoiding that is keeping you stuck? And what would it look like for us to choose something different? For us to, rather than avoid, to engage, rather than do it all on our own, to make a request to enroll the resources around me? What would it look like for us, rather than to sit in apathy, to choose messy action and see what results can be generated. Because if I'm willing to do something, I think God is capable of doing anything. So that's on a very high level.
I remember that exercise where it was just like, come up with like, what are two or three of your just basic complaints? Like, what are things that you complain about and on all these different things? But that was that core phrase where it's just to take the ownership of, because that's exactly the way I want it to be. And it's, and then you just do this exercise of you like repeat, like, this is my complaint. And then say that at the end of it, like three different times. And you're just like, well, crap, like that's all my fault. Like,
and by the way, if you're offended, look twice at that thing. The thing, if you try on the phrase and you're like, oh, forget that. Like, that's an offensive. It is not exactly the way that I want it. Like, hold on, sit with it for just a second, because wherever we're offended is probably where the next breakthrough is.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I've even used that exercise with a couple of people that I've talked to over the last year or so. And a gal that was just struggling with like just this nonprofit leader and just, oh, my team is doing this and they're just acting immature and there's doing this X, Y, Z. And then I just had her do that thing. And she's like, and I don't like that at all. Like I or like another guy where it's just like, it was a leader of an organization and one of the board members, like he was just having just this tense time relationally, kind of a power struggle, all these different things. And we just ran that exercise with him again. And it was just like for him to own a significant part of his piece and that agency aspect of, man, how could I literally behave differently in order to move the needle and some of that stuff. And so just that ownership, I don't know, that was just a really fun kind of meta performance exercise as I, you know, just walking through some of those tools, man, just the, what are we capable of, the reality vision gap, the intuitive fence, some of the ownership, that question. And there's probably 20 other questions on here that I never even got a chance to talk to you about, but, to wrap, I'd love to just kind of hear your thoughts initially. So you're the president of the Meta Performance Institute, which literally trains coaches to do what you do. To be executive coaches. And I'm curious if you have any people in this of any pastors or even church planters that are doing like bivocational or like co-vocational ministry as an executive coach on the side and what that kind of looks like in their context right now.
We do. We have several examples. Some come to mind right now. I know of I'm counting in my head. I would need more than one hand to count how many of my colleagues are very dedicated in local ministry and are also meta performance coaches in Novus Global, and are leading effectively in both of those spaces. And the reason that is true, Andrew, is because a lot of the work overlaps. So by becoming an exceptional meta performance coach, they often become better pastors. By really leaning into pastoral ministry, they become better executive coaches because the foundations are identical. We are convinced that we are transformed by the renewing of our mind. And we are convinced that there is more to life than performance. We are convinced that the most important questions are the ones that we would rather avoid. Search me, God, know my heart, test me and know my anxious thoughts. How am I relating to the gap? I'm anxious. I want to avoid. I want to run away. Sit with that. What would it mean to take courageous action in the midst of all of those emotions? So that's why you see a lot of people who succeed in both categories. In fact, I think people with ministry backgrounds make exceptional meta performance coaches. Some of the best. I think they have a massive head start in this work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Give me a quick like 15-second commercial on like what is like the Meta Performance Institute, like if somebody was like interested in and just going deeper into seeing what this looks like, what is that?
Yeah, really quickly, I would say just go to our website, which is MP, that's like Meta Performance, MP.institute. And on there is a whole host of resources, and start there. And the first step for many people is to set up a conversation with one of the team to talk about what the work looks like and to see if maybe that's a right next step for them. So go to mp.institute and you'll see ways to contact us, and myself or one of my team would love to talk to you about this work and see if it's a good fit for you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, Joseph, dude, so thankful for who you are, what you do, and for your time with us. You guys can follow Joseph on LinkedIn for sure. A lot of great content that you continually post on there, a lot of inspiring stuff, a lot of challenging stuff. There's a Meta Performance podcast, right? Or Novus yeah. Global podcast that you guys can listen to, the book Beyond High Performance, and a slew of other resources as well. But just so grateful for your time, man. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Andrew. Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.